This episode is brought to you by Vuori. I love sports. I know you do too. I also know that lots of you exercise, but if you're like me and my wife, the beloved sports gal, you're sick and tired of ugly, uncomfortable workout gear, especially, you know, I do a lot of walking. I walk around LA. I make calls. I listen to podcasts. Here are two words that will change everything. Vuori clothing, a line of activewear that is unbelievable. The best thing about Vuori is you can lounge around in it. You can work out in it. You can go outside. You can go shopping down in your local wherever. And you never feel like you're either underdressed or overdressed. You're just comfortable. You can wear it when you're training, traveling, lounging around the house. Go get yourself some of the most comfortable and versatile clothing on the planet. Here's the deal. Our listeners get 20% off their first purchase at Vuori.com/Simmons. Once again, Vuori.com/Simmons. This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid, featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God. The world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
So on this episode, I talk to the man with the pen. Well, the pen that signed my first big contract anyway. Former CEO of Leicester Tigers, the powerful, the wonderful Simon Cohen.
Get in! Yeah!
Big Jim is wearing his heels. Marching around the town. Get some thrills, but it's time to go in now, and he's big and red, a shot of black coffee, now he's super dead, he gets loud, I'm a beer dick house, I showed him off some whiskey, and he shoot me like a ball.
Right, I'm with the old guard, the good guard, Simon Cohen. It's been a few years since we've spoken properly. But we've known each other. I was trying to think back through the archives. You've known me and I've known you since I was 17, 18 years old.
Yeah, well, when I first went to Leicester 2005, I thought I've always been a big fan on having a local core that makes the heart and soul of a rugby club, whether that's professional or not. And when I first went to Tigers, there was a group of lads who I thought were brilliant and not necessarily the big names. Some of them were, some of them weren't, but there was people like yourself, Brett Deacon, Will Skinner, Sam Vesti, Dan Hipkiss. And you all invited me out for a curry when I got there. And I thought, this is weird, but it's brilliant as well. And, you know, then you sort of chart the ups and downs of those 17, 18-year-old kids for the next 20 years. And it's been an amazing journey, I think, for all of them in different ways. I think being part of a rugby club obviously creates, particularly Tigers back in the day, created an environment which allowed people to be very real and to flourish in that reality. It was fantastic.
Yeah, because like I think now, and it's weird, I'm sat here now, retired from rugby and been through so many different experiences that started at Leicester through to different clubs, playing for Scotland for 10 years, being at Saracens, and now, bizarrely, I found myself in the media and we're doing a podcast together. But when it all comes back round and when I think about it and when people say, oh, who were your biggest influences in your career? What was it? What was the turning point? For me, it was Leicester. It was Dean Richards. It was Dusty Hare. It was Tom Smith. It was Dosser Smith. It was Redders. It was yourself. And it's a big statement for me to make, but it is the absolute truth. Gave me a life. I had nothing. And part of me doing these spin-offs, Simon, and speaking to guys like you, is also the growth and to talk about the growth of the game, but also to kind of tell a bit of my story. And I think back to the days when you gave me my first kind of biggish contract. I could afford a car. That's what I'm trying to say. I could buy myself clothes. And I'm forever grateful for that because I was in a right state, was I not?
Look, if somebody had told me that the bloke who was naked on the coach going home from a game would write the quality of columns that you currently write, articulate, intelligent, etc., I would have been somewhat surprised. That's true.
There goes written though.
but But I think the thing about Leicester is that you had to understand the game, and you look at the great coaches that came through that system. So Chalky White set up a system which created a lot of coaches. Then Dosser and Paul Dodge created a lot of coaches. Dean Richards created a lot of coaches. And so I think to play for Tigers, you had to have an understanding of the game. To have that understanding of the game, you had to have an intelligence. Now, for me, you don't measure intelligence by exam results. You know, lots of people have an innate intelligence without necessarily passing loads of exams. And I think to survive at Leicester and play a lot of games, you had to have an understanding of how the game worked. To do that, you had to be pretty bright. And you had to be streetwise to succeed at Leicester. So everybody who is there had those two qualities, first and foremost. And they were sort of reasonably resilient and tough. Because if you come through an environment which is Dean Richards, which is Richard Cockerell, you have to be resilient and you have to be tough, because those are two qualities they really valued.
And that's changed now, hasn't it, in terms of the way that the game is, for a number of reasons. But you think back to them days at Leicester, the successful years, and you were a large part of that. I was kind of involved in that from a young lad standpoint. And Leicester now, we can come on to that. A lot's obviously happened for yourself, also the team as well. But you go back to what Leicester used to be like and the external perception of just a bunch of rough heads going around scrapping, and that's what Leicester was. There's this kind of myth around Martin Johnson, Dean Richards, Neil Back, the ABC Club, Roundtree, Cockerell, Garforth, you know what I mean? Neil Back. It was just absolute chaos, but it was built on more than that from a cultural standpoint and where the success came from.
Oh, undoubtedly. But like you say, that toughness, which was legendary, it was all part of intimidating the opposition. And to be fair to Steve Borthwick, that's one of the things that he's brought back with a vengeance. People seem scared to come to Welford Road again now, and I think that's fantastic, because clubs very rarely go away from what their core values are. So if you look at you can create a core value from scratch, but once you've created that core value, that is the values of the club. And that's what's always made Tigers really good. You can't imagine Harlequins being successful playing a very tight, narrow game. It just doesn't seem to fit in with the culture. And Tigers has always been, let's be tough.
What was your role then? Because people listen to this wouldn't necessarily know your complete role. I know it evolved over the years, but a snapshot of kind of what you did at your time at Leicester. How long were you there for?
15 years, and then 2 wonderful years on garden leave.
You look great. Garden leave sounds like a wonderful thing, but it's probably not.
No, it's garden leave in a pandemic is a wonderful thing. No, look, I had 2 roles there effectively. First of all, I came in as head of rugby operations, so tried to take all the non-coaching responsibilities away from the coach to allow them to do the coaching. And then I was chief operating officer for a short period of time, and then I was chief executive for the next 7 years.
What was that like?
Which one?
All of them. Give us a snapshot of what it's like being at the business end of a rugby club.
Well, I'd probably, at the time that I went to Leicester, I'd probably, as a lawyer and as an agent, I'd probably done more rugby contracts than anybody else. So I went into Leicester with what I thought was a huge knowledge, and found out that I knew almost nothing about what the real world inside a rugby club was like. It's brilliant, it's magical, especially when the team's going well. So those years working with Pat Howard and Richard Cockerell, I enjoyed as much as anything I've ever done in my career. You're working with players who are good people. And some of that contract stuff, as you know, is difficult, because the players rightly want to get as much as they want. The club has to get the best possible team it can out of the salary cap. And there are some tough calls to make. And I think as long as you're honest, you'll never come out of it being liked, but hopefully you come out of it being respected. And I love that, working closely, because if you're in that role, you feel part of a team, part of a club. You're in there, there's some banter, you're eating with the players, all that's really good fun. Chief executive, you become a bit more distant, and you're sort of in between, which is quite hard. So, you know, you have a board that takes the big decisions, of which you're part of, but you're not actually at the training ground. You're not actually talking to the players every day. You're not as involved in that world. And obviously, because of my background, I probably got more involved in it than most CEOs did. But still, you're a little bit distant from it. So you have more of an overview, so you have more responsibility, but it's certainly not as much fun as it is being closer to the team and the training ground.
Mm, because you had the magic pen. That's how I saw you and Dino at the time. I remember it was just before your time where I was in South Africa, and then I was on $2,500 to $5,000 a year, and I had a labouring job as well on the side at David Wilson Home, sweeping houses and putting up the plasterboard. And I went to South Africa, and I got this unbelievable contract offer from Moseley, right? So Moseley offered me $12,500. They had a guy called Mal Malik. He's rang me when I'm in South Africa and said, look, we've heard that you're potentially being underpaid. You're working on a building site. Come to Rugby Lions, first big contract, $12,500 a year. We're going to give you a house, put you up in a house, and we're going to give you a car. What car do you want? I said, a Ford Escort. He said, done. And then I came back and Dino was like, what's this about Rugby Lions? I was like, mate, I'm off. And he's like, no, you fucking not. Took me into the office, put a contract across the table. It was my first big contract, $10,000. Gave me the pen and said, you're signing that now. And then that was the point where I realised the magic of the pen and the contract, and then you came in. When you look at that time with the Tigers, how good and how influential they were in such an important era, the amateur to professional gap that needed to be bridged, obviously. And the big one for me, and again, because he did so much for me, is Dean Richards. How that ended at Leicester for me, I'll never know. He had a bar there, and then he ends up at Quinn's, and we know what happened at Quinn's. To see him finish, and like again, this isn't me belittling Newcastle, but for me, Dino is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, right? And he's finished at Newcastle. Hopefully he's not finished. How do you think all that was dealt with at Leicester? Like everything that he went through. And in 2003, you got to think, most of the team were at the World Cup and he got judged on the performances then. But I know as an agent, you were obviously dealing with Dino when you came in.
Oh, look, I'm the same as you. When I ran rugby holidays for kids back in the 80s, Dean would give up his time willingly to come and coach, and I've got on really well with him since then. He's got a fantastic knowledge. I think the job he's done at Newcastle, given the limited budget, has been amazing. He's been very unlucky, I think. But coming back to the ending at Leicester, I think everybody's endings at Leicester are quite difficult. And that's quite a good thing in a way, because the environment's pretty ruthless. The environment's pretty brutal. I think that's part and parcel of what makes Leicester Leicester. But it was a shame that he left, certainly, because he'd done so much good there and was so much a part of it. You know, it's quite difficult, isn't it, to affect an ending in an environment where you're judged every single Saturday. Pat Howard used to say it's like having an AGM every Saturday. So you've got to move on pretty quickly, and I get that. But Dean was so unfortunate, because what happened at Quinn's was not handled well by the authorities, I didn't think. I thought, given that there was a lot of that fake blood floating around, and given that Dean was done mainly for a cover-up, but the cover-up was not to cover it up. The cover-up was to protect the people that worked for him, because that was Dean. To take somebody's livelihood away for 3 years, I thought was draconian. And, you know, the punishment didn't fit the crime in any way, shape or form for me. That was very, very harsh on such a great servant of the game.
It was trial by media, like everything is now. And that was probably the time where it came in, obviously, with Tom Williams. I think it was the winger, wasn't it, who came off winking and stuff like that. I mean, wow, that shifted the dial, didn't it? You forget, was it 3 years, Dino, stood down for?
Terrible. I thought that was a terrible, terrible punishment. The media does influence the punishments. I remember doing Manu's hearing after he punched Chris Ashton, and Sky had shown that image of Chris Ashton's head rocking backwards and forwards.
He took it well, didn't he?
The punch?
Yeah.
Well, it was quite... I went into the dressing room immediately afterwards to hear Julian White berating Manu for not punching properly. Apparently he was on his tiptoes or something.
He was in the air. He jumped. He was in the air. No power.
Yeah, no power. Yes. I don't know whether it was Manu's best shot that Chris took. But yeah, he was still standing, wasn't he? Which is quite a feat. Not so much with Geordie, I think, because there was an incident in one of the Saints games where Chris, funny enough, Chris features again.
Of course he does.
Where he dragged Alisana by his hair, which, given Alisana was Alisana and a Tulagi, it just seemed not the most sensible thing to do. Anyway, there's a free-for-all breaks out near the touchline. And when I watched it back with Cockers, and we saw Geordie rush in and thump somebody twice, and they didn't even notice.
Yeah, Geordie's not much of a scrapper. But, you know, Ashi, obviously, as we know, he's at Leicester now. But do you know the story where the Tuolangi said you're never welcome back in Leicester? So I think the Tuolangis have given him the keys to the stadium, the training facility, in terms of he can turn up, but he's not allowed to live in Leicester. So he has to live outside of Leicestershire. So.
Oh, look, they're very forgiving people, aren't they? I think they live their lifestyle in a really good way. They move on, don't they? I think I'd be surprised if that was a true story.
We'll say it's true. Simon, when did the dial shift in terms of how much players wanted? When did the dial become out of control where it got to a point where you talk about balancing the books? We're now seeing whether or not the numbers are true. Carl Sinclair, Genji, myself are talking about it quite publicly on social media. Mark Evans isn't too happy about me talking about it. In terms of how much players are paid and the fact that 100 players, whether or not that is the number, I don't know if that's the number, you might be able to shed a light on that, can't find contracts. When did that dial shift so much that it became out of control in terms of what players were demanding and what agents were valuing the players at?
I think what changed it was when Bruce Craig pushed through the second marquee player. I think that was the point at which it changed, because I think players were pretty understanding of one marquee player. So if you got your marquee player right, and who is a formidable talent, missing piece in the jigsaw or whatever, most of the players would accept that one player was paid quite a lot more than them. When it became two marquee players, I think that was the point in which players said, well, he might be very good on his 500,000, but I'm worth at least half as much as him, so I want 250,000. And they might have been on 120,000, 130,000 beforehand. I think that's the point at which the dial moved in the UK. And the salary cap didn't help, because the salary cap is a fantastic mechanism for controlling your main uncontrollable cost, which is players' wages. So you have a mechanism that can control wages, keep clubs solvent, keep clubs financially stable, and you allow it to be manipulated to a point where it doesn't do that. And for me, an example would be that PRL did a budget one year, and the budget in revenue terms included a benefit in kind value for things like balls were included. So you got the balls, but they'd put a monetary value in the budget. Anyway, the salary cap was increased to a point that the playing costs should have been covered by the budget. But what happened in actual terms is that PRL didn't make their targets. So the actual revenue that came in to cover the salary cap increase was probably about £1 million per club less than the forecast revenue. So the salary cap had made that huge jump over what the club revenues were, and the players' salaries went up accordingly. The squad numbers never really changed, because you know what you need to run a 32-game season. You know, you're probably going to be between 38 and 42 players with some top-end academy players. So the numbers never changed. All that changed is with the salary cap going up was that the same players got more money. So a combination of those two things, I think, were the main triggers for player wage inflation.
And so with that, with the salary cap stuff, what were your views on the Saracen stuff? And you've got to remember, you were still at the club at the time, and you're watching what's happening at Saracens. I'm obviously there at the time. Leicester are struggling. Wasps are losing Elliot Daly to Saracens. The URC, Leinster don't have a salary cap. These teams in France, it's double, triple the salary cap. So you as a CEO and the coaches, Geordie at the time, what's it like being in an environment where you're trying to balance the books? I know there was a few discrepancies with Leicester. What are your views on the salary cap and trying to manage that, if you want to compete at the highest level on three or four different competition fronts?
Oh, look, clearly you can't do that within the salary cap. It's impossible. And Saracens, in a way, have proved that. The salary cap stuff is always quite, for me, it's quite interesting, because there's some moral issues around beating the cap. There's some legal issues around it that make it not as simplistic as people seem to feel it is. I'll give you an example. On the moral side, you get quite often get a front row who, or a scrum that will be dominant in three or four scrums. They'll get a scrum under the opponent's post and they themselves will drop that scrum because they know they'll get the penalty. Or Neil Back's hand in the scrum that won a European Cup. Is that any different from exploiting a loophole in the salary cap regulations? Morally, is it different? I don't know, because everybody tries to exploit the wording of the regulations. I mean,
do they though? That's the thing. I think I know the answer because I'm close to the game and understand. And that's the big thing. Exeter come out, Tony Rowe makes big signs and obviously raging about what happened at Saracens, because it is such a interesting debate and you've been on the business side of it. Do you think there are more people that are?
Well, I think everybody tries to exploit the regulation. If you've got the money, you try and exploit the regulations. But it's so, in a way, it's random where they hit. Let's talk about the Saracens one, because there's been a judgment that's been issued publicly. We can talk about that. So Saracens are found to be guilty. One of the planks of their guilt is that Nigel Ray overpaid by £800,000 for a share in Maro Itoje's image rights company. The panel here, too, experts, one for Saracens, one for PRL, and decide that it is an overpayment. There's no hard evidence, really, apart from these valuations. Now, it seems to me that if that hearing was now, Maro Itoje's gone with Roc Nation.
Undervalued, you're going to say, aren't you?
Potentially, yes. Mm. Because it valued Maro's image rights company at £5 million. And the panel said that was much too much. You look at where Maro might be now. You see him as the face of Marks and Spencers. I saw yesterday he'd posted pictures of himself with Charles and Camilla. He's with Roc Nation. They are pretty savvy commercially, and they're a worldwide global organisation. For Nigel's money to be getting a third of the money that would be coming in now, I think it would be very hard to say that that wasn't a genuine transaction. Now, on the other side of it, if you have a club that has, let's say, £100,000 headroom left in this season. So all the games are finished apart from the final. So if you're not, as long as you're not Saracens and Leicester, you know where your bonuses sit. You know exactly the money you're going to be paying out. If you've got £100,000 headroom, and if you've got a player who next year is on £200,000, what you can do is you can enter into a new contract that pays him £100,000 bonus now, and only £100,000 salary next year. That's completely legal. It's within the regs. Lots of clubs do it. But it is an exercise that is designed solely to give more headroom in the cap the following year. That's all it achieves. So you compare one that is completely legal with one that, in my view, somewhat dubiously has been deemed to be illegal. And it's quite an interesting juxtaposition for me.
Well, Saracens took a gamble and it paid off. I don't think we kind of knew. Oh, we did know that Maro was going to potentially transcend the game. So the valuation on that. But it was a manipulation around, obviously, the salary cap. And I know it's old news. People listen to this be like, oh, come on, let's move on. But I want to move on to where the game becomes sustainable when you decrease the salary cap. And back to my question around the amount of players now that have had to leave because the clubs can't afford them because they can't, literally cannot fit them in the salary cap. So how, from your standpoint, and you can probably say now being on the outside, do you believe in the salary cap reduction? Do you think, and again, Mark Evans, a guy who you respect highly, he's got me by the balls at the minute because of what I'm saying, and he thinks that I've got a voice in the rugby public domain, which was amazing for him to say. But we disagree in terms of, I think players should try and get as much as they can because of the career being so short, the stuff that we spoke about off air in terms of aftercare, which isn't there. And that means that rich owners need to just keep paying and paying and paying. So twofold question, Simon Cohen. Do you think the salary cap needs to be scrapped or increased in order to fight on all fronts and have a bigger squads? And do you think the owners should be paying, or do you think it's a ridiculous statement for myself and other people to be making that sugar daddies should just keep pumping money in? Or do you think there's a business model for them to make money and become profitable?
I think that they can be profitable, but they have to control costs like you do in any business. And the biggest cost, of course, is the player's salary. So as I said earlier, the salary cap gives you a mechanism for doing that. If what you want is to control costs, then you have to utilise the salary cap, and it has to come down to a point where the bottom club in the league is still at least breaking even. If your criteria about what's good for the game is simply going to be winning trophies, then of course you go the other way and you get rid of the cap and it becomes a free-for-all. But I think there's investor fatigue. There's a lot of clubs that have either publicly been for sale or privately would be willing to sell who cannot find buyers at the moment. That can't be good for the game. There's probably a slight decline that has been in various years recently in the numbers of adult players playing the game. The concussion issue is coming round the corner quite quickly. There's lots of issues for the game to deal with. And if you want to develop the game, you have to make sure that those costs are kept under control. And I think also there's an element of ensuring that there's a balance of the revenue that comes into rugby being made available across the game. You know, it's quite difficult for some of the women's teams at the moment, for instance, because, and I know there's a commerciality argument then, but, you know, there could be a lot of good achieved by putting some more money into that part of the game. Certainly the community game, in terms of some schools stopping playing rugby, could do with a little bit more help there. So I think it depends what you want to do for the game. For me, the lack of governance in the game means that we've come to a really difficult position because everybody has just fought their own corner. And whichever sphere of governance you look at, there's very little independent governance, and therefore he who shouts loudest has probably got his way for the most part. What the game needs in every aspect, I think, is a reset. It's clear to most people what the game looks like at its best. You'd have, in England, you'd probably have two leagues of 10, you know, with a decently funded championship. The Six Nations, you could argue there's too much international rugby played, and some of that international rugby is played simply to generate revenue to pay the players those sums that we've talked about earlier. If you took the money out, would the game be better with a Five Nations promotion and relegation? Would that help develop the game? You'd have a yo-yo effect, of course, but would it over time help develop the game into areas where it's not traditionally developed? And these are the sort of things that you would hope would be able to be achieved. But maybe because we've come so far on this road, the only way it can be achieved is for the game virtually to go broke and start again. And it seems to me that in some areas of the game, we're not that far away from that. We have a system now where, according to the newspapers, the Worcester players didn't get paid at the end of last month. Now, can you imagine as a player what that's like? So you're not on huge amounts of money. You've got a wife, a couple of kids, you've got a mortgage. Your mortgage payment goes out on the 25th of the month. 26th of the month, nothing comes in. Now, and that's within the Premiership. That doesn't seem to me to be the basis for growing the game, developing the game. And I don't see that some of the investment that has come in has done much more than simply pay the players more money. Mm. And I think that's, if you're talking about developing the game, that seems to be a waste. If you're talking simply about winning trophies, it's clearly not.
Well, who's running the show, Simon? When it's all said and done, should there be one particular point? Because World Rugby get a lot of hate, right? Oh, World Rugby this, World Rugby that. I don't think they make decisions. Who are the big players? Who are the kingpins? Who are the ones that we should be asking questions of at the very top? Who has the keys to the kingdom?
Well, I think in every level of governance, you need some independence. You look at the Premier Rugby Board, the Investor Board, which is comprised of the club chairman. How is it possible for them to take a decision that might be in the best interest of the league if it goes against the best interest of their club? It puts them in an impossible position. The way around that is to have proper independent governance. You know, some of the American leagues have a commissioner who just makes the decisions, but you could do that by having more independence on a board. There are lots of ways of achieving that, but I think you've got to do that. You've got to have people who take decisions for the benefit of wider organisations. So I think if at World Rugby level, those decisions were not taken by the member nations. And you've got different voting rights with different nations in world rugby, which seems strange in a democratic environment. But if you took that away, those voting rights to the individual countries, and had more independent governments, maybe world rugby would be able to make those decisions around the calendar. And I think, as I say, I think the game needs a reset. So I think you do what's right for the game and deal with the consequences of that, rather than always having to try and find more and more money to pay players to create this. It's a bit like the chapter in Gulliver's Travels where everybody took in everybody else's washing to make a living. We're just living in this vicious circle where everybody's efforts are based not to make the game better, but to pay players more and more. And once somebody, it's a bit like an arms race, isn't it? Once somebody does it, somebody else has to do it. In England, there's always been somebody. Sir John Hall started that with Newcastle back in the day. You know, sort of Bruce Craig, Nigel Ray have pumped large sums of money into their clubs to make them successful. Stephen Lansdowne presumably is doing that with Bristol. As long as you allow a situation where there's always somebody who can spend more money, then I think it's going to be very hard to stop that arms race. But I think stop it, you do need to get the game on a level footing. Because if you don't, you run a risk that everybody goes bust at the same time.
Mm.
This episode is brought to you by Anytime Fitness. We're not all professional athletes, but we all have health goals. That's why Anytime Fitness gives you access to personalized plans and support from a coach. Plus, you can track your training, nutrition, and recovery progress with the Anytime Fitness app, just like the pros. With 24/7 access to more than 5,000 gyms worldwide, get more from your gym membership. Visit anytimefitness.com to try it for free today. Terms, conditions, restrictions all apply. See website for details.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This episode is brought to you by Lincoln and the all-new 2024 Nautilus Hybrid, featuring a customizable 48-inch panoramic display, available Revel audio system, and available perfect position front seats with active motion massage. Oh my God, the world isn't wide enough. Visit Lincoln.com to learn more. Some models, trims, and features may not be available or may be subject to change. Check with your local retailer for current information. Lincoln and Nautilus are trademarks of Ford or its affiliates.
Because you're going down my route a little bit, because you've just mentioned the big players who are happy to pump money into the game. So if you were to say the game needs a reset, and let's be harsh, let's do it, right? Where you cut a Worcester out who don't want to pay the players, you cut a Newcastle out who haven't got the money, you cut, I don't know, Simon Orange, I'm going to get him on here, so he's going to hate me for saying it, but if he doesn't want to invest anymore and they're looking for a sustainable model in rugby, which clearly is not there and it's not there anytime soon. So say we're sat here now in the Spotify studios in London and we go for the great reset. What do you do?
I wouldn't go down that road, because who does the clubs that are left play against? Now, if you look at football, which is a pretty mature professional game in terms of it's been around for an awful long time, they've been through lots of pitfalls. What works best for them, and I think would work best for England certainly, is that you have a domestic league where the European games are the icing on the cake. Exactly like football with the Premiership and Champions League. That's what's worked. I think 14 teams is too many. I think anything that creates conferences is a bad thing. Because you look at Tigers, for instance, their traditional rivalries, they've shifted around a little bit, but Saints, Bath, you know, those are traditional rivalries for them. And what you want is for them to continue to exist. They might not under a conference system. And I think that would dilute people's interest in the game. And that's the last thing you want to do. Lack of promotion, relegation, I think, has diluted people's interest in the game. You don't want to do that. You want to increase people's interest in the game. So you need a domestic league. So you need at least 10 teams. Now, that's fine if you've got 10 owners who are willing to lose £3, £4, £5 million a year every year And when they get bored with it, you can find somebody else who'll do the same. That's not going to happen. So your route, much as it gives more money to the players, Jim, and buys...
And it makes it more exciting.
And buys every single player Harley Davidson. It's for me, not viable. It's not the future.
Mm. Where do you think we'll be in 5 years? Give us a kind of a guess. And it is a guess, because I think people listening to you, Simon, who's been at the coalface of it, who's now out of it, looking at it, talking to people that potentially want to invest in the game. If you were at the table with CVC and they said to you, having been at the forefront, what does this look like in 5 years? From an investment point of view, you know, take the concussion stuff out there, player welfare, we're working through that. From a commercial model and a sustainability, do you think we can find it in the next 5 to 10 years? Do you think it will be there?
My best guess is if you asked 100 people involved in rugby, if they won the lottery, would they invest in rugby? 100 people would say no, because all you've got is an arms race where you lose money. Now, that's great if you want to get it to a point where you win a trophy and then you get out and that gives you that satisfaction, but that's not viable for the future. And until they change the governance models, I only see it getting worse and worse and more difficult until it breaks, and then there'll have to be a reset.
Do you think it will break?
I think it could well break. I think I look at the clubs' balance sheets and the profit and losses across the league, and what I see is people were coming to the breaking point, and then the CVC money came in. They came to a pandemic. Everybody got through the pandemic. They're congratulating themselves for getting through the pandemic, but they've got through the pandemic for the most part with significant loans, which now have to be repaid, which from numbers that for the most part are not back at pre-pandemic levels yet. So I think it's just going to get harder and harder. It could well break. As we've talked about, we're already in the Premiership in a position where players didn't get paid at the end of 1 month, according to reports, and that's in the Premiership. The Championship is in a difficult state financially and, you know, sustained in lots of cases by owners, again by owners who are prepared at a more limited level than the Premiership to put money in. If you're sustained purely by owners willing to invest and there's some investor fatigue around and it's difficult to find new owners, yeah, of course, you could, half a dozen clubs could go bust in the next 5 years.
Leicester, let's talk about it. You've been on gardening leave for 2 years. You were there for so many years. I'm sure there's things that you can't talk about, and people listen to this, there'll be a few Leicester fans. And like you said, things don't end well at Leicester. Dino, you mentioned Cocker's, it didn't end well for him. I mean, but an absolute legend of the club, Jordan Murphy, and we can maybe talk a little bit about him without speaking for him. Like yourself, what kind of transpired towards the end? You could see, and I think we've spoken to you on the Rugby Pod before, and you know, I had my opinions on Leicester, and they've had a complete clear out, which at face value seems to have worked because they've made the final of the Premiership, and after this goes out, might have won the Premiership. What can you say about that? Are you all right about it or not?
Oh, yeah, look, I'm really delighted for two reasons. First of all, take huge pride in the building blocks that were put in place. You know, I was able to bring Steve Borthwick in. If you look at the squad, Steve signed 3 years ago. So for any head coach, 3 years is viewed as a contract cycle and you can change your squad pretty dramatically within that 3 years. But if you look at the team that he put out for the semi-final, 99% of it were the team that was recruited by Jed and by Dusty and by Geordie and by Jan. So that building block was in place. You look at the work that Jed and Dusty did in the academy that's producing these players that are doing wonderfully well. That's all in place. So I take great pride in putting the building blocks in place or being part of a team that did. I'm really pleased for the people that went through those difficult times. So Cocker's always said the only two groups that matter are the fans and the players. I think he was being a little bit modest about the coaches, but certainly the rest of us were purely administrators. So for those two main groups, the fans who are just brilliant, for instance, you go to Exeter to watch the game, Tigers against Exeter, you know when you're not playing well, you're unlikely to come away with something, and it's a long way. You get to Gloucester Services and there's hundreds and hundreds of Leicester fans just getting off the buses, having a cup of tea, have a chat with them. They're just brilliant, I think, and you're so pleased that they're seeing such success. And also the players, you know, there's a lot of players almost all the players there at the moment went through those difficult times. So for them, I think it's fantastic that they got a chance to play in a Premiership final. And you know that, like you said, you have a very emotional connection with Leicester when you're part of it, players particularly. So you know that those players care about the club. So for those players to have gone through the difficult times, almost got relegated, and now to be in a Premiership final, for Genji, for Fordy, it's their last game. How emotional will that be for them? People like Dan Cole, who've been there forever, just be brilliant for him, for the young kids. Kids, fantastic, who come through the academy and a very successful academy. It's great for them, for people like Harry Wells, Callum Green, who sort of came through the academy, went away and came back. And also for people like Brett Deacon and Matt Smith, who've been there forever. I'm so pleased for those people that they're getting that success. So for me, no mixed emotion at all, just absolutely delighted for those two groups of people.
Yeah, that's class to hear. For Jordan Murphy, it must be bloody tough, though. And you look at what he did for the club as a player and as a coach, but then how it ended. It must be, and I've had this chat with my mate John Barkley before, when you drop from a team, right? And you get dropped and someone comes in and you have to act as if you're desperate for the team to win. Now, I don't care. There could be a few that are desperate for the team to win, but if you've been dropped, you're fucking raging, right? You're absolutely raging. You do want the team to win, but that you want the guy who's taking your position to have an absolute shocker. That's a fact. Anyone who tells you any different, that's the way it is. But for Jordy, the character that he is, it still must be incredibly tough for him to watch. Like you've just said, you mentioned Dusty and Jed and guys like yourself, and people be like, oh yeah, yeah, you put it all together. It's a fact. I was with the academy a couple of years ago with Freddie Stewart coming through, George Martin, Van Poortvliet at 9. Leicester Tigers Academy were winning everything. They were phenomenal. So you could see there was going to be an eventual change of guard. And then obviously Borthwick comes in, gets to work with the players. And yes, he's done an incredible job. But someone like Jordy had a huge influence on that. If he's watching Leicester top the league, how tough is it for someone? Or is that just professional sport? Or do you think it's more than that for someone like him?
Oh, look, you'd have to speak to Jordy about that. I speak to him a bit, but I wouldn't like to second guess how he's feeling about this. But what I do know about Jordy is he's a top bloke. He was a top player for Leicester and he cares passionately about the club. So it must have been very difficult for him. And like you say, there may be mixed emotions there, but I think his love for the club means that he'll want them to win. And I'm sure that he would have liked to have been there, because when you go through some difficult years, you'd love the opportunity to turn it round. And he hasn't had that opportunity. He left after I did, so I don't know what the factors involved were in his departure. Certainly, I think that, you know, he was there when I sort of pushed very hard for Steve Borthwick to come to the club. And he was very happy with that. He thought that Steve, as he has been, would be an excellent addition. And certainly at the time, he thought he could work with Steve and they'd work quite well together. As you say, it's just a shame it didn't pan out like that.
Matt, I think you're well placed to talk about this stuff, even from a lawyer standpoint.
Yeah, I mean, lawyers are generally quite boring. I mean, I remember that big night in 2007 where, you know, some people, maybe including you, Jim, were...
You can say it's me, defamation of character. I'm here, I don't
topless
mind.
Topless in the kitchen fighting.
Hang on, that's defamation, because I wasn't in the kitchen. It was Henry Tuolangi and Seru Rambini.
Where somebody called the police, where one policeman turned up, looked at it and went, oh shit, and called the riot police. The riot police came and pepper sprayed everybody. Some of the lads spent the night in the nick.
Guilty.
I'd gone to bed early.
How do you deal with that? Like that, when people listen to that, they're thinking, well, it's a made up story. I've spoken about it, so people are thinking, oh, well, it is made up then. But that's a true story. That was 2007 when we beat Wasps in the final of the Prem. Was it Wasps we beat? No, Gloucester.
Gloucester.
And then we lost to Wasps in Europe.
Well, we were on a treble, because we'd beaten, the Ospreys in the Anglo-Welsh, beaten Gloucester, and then on the final leg of the treble, lost to Wasps in the European final. So we'd come back to Welford Road, and it was a really weird atmosphere, because you should have been celebrating a double, a fantastic season, getting to three finals, winning two of them. But actually, on the day, you'd been beaten in the biggest final of them all, arguably the European final. So It was a bit of a malevolent mood. You knew that something was going to go wrong that night. And it's a pretty volatile mix, and so it's proved. But it's, you know, for me, it's different. I did a lot of the disciplinary hearings. So it's very different from the situation that you get on the field when you're sort of having to deal with the disciplinary off the field. I mean, Julian White, you could write a book about Julian's disciplinary hearings and the stories that came out of it. Just fantastic stories. He punched Malcolm O'Kelly when we played Leinster at Welford Road. He punched him twice. I heard Joel Jude, who was refereeing, go, stop it now. Julian punched him twice more after that. Went into the dressing room afterwards because I knew that there was going to be a discipline. He was going to get cited. There was going to be a disciplinary hearing. And I went, right, Julian, we need to get our story sorted for the hearing. And it'll be in Dublin. It'll be Tuesday night. I said, there must have been some provocation. What did he do to make you punch him four times? And Julian went, well, I actually don't think he did anything.
That's our Julian.
And I went to, he punched Andrew Sheridan and got sent off against Sale. And it was a one punch, so it's a one game ban. It was pretty standard, save for the fact that at the time in the regulations, if you were a persistent offender, they could ban you for a much longer period. It was the chairman of the panel was His Honour Judge Jeff Blackett, who is one of the country's senior judges. And I went, my job today, Mr. Chairman, is to persuade you that Julian White is not a persistent offender. And he said, I have to stop you there, Mr. Cohen. He phoned down to his secretary or his PA and he said, can you bring up another pot of tea? It's going to be a long afternoon. You know, and these things I think are sort of just fantastic stories, aren't they? And what made the club what it was. Just great people and great characters, I think. And I worry that the game is losing some of that character. You know, you've still got people like Coley's got a brilliant sense of humour, hasn't he?
He's not on TikTok though, so I don't respect him like that.
Genji's pretty interesting. Genji's a character, but they're less so because it's become more of a job, I think. They still have fun and they're still good people. Look at Freddie Burns. Freddie's a top bloke. When he was at Leicester, he sort of dragged everybody around him and he became a focal point for lots of the boys that weren't already in established sort of cliques, groups, whatever, friendship groups. And I thought he was absolutely brilliant. Although he did tell a story recently about me sacking him over a Nando's.
Oh, I did. Yeah, I've heard the story. He's told us before.
Yes, it's not true.
Oh, is it not true?
Not
on record.
On the record. That's the Nando's bit was true.
So you took him for a Nando's?
Oh, yeah. Took everybody for a Nando's, didn't I? Mm-hmm. There were so many contracts done in Nando's, it's just not true. To be honest, of all the things that I've had and lost within a career, the loss of that Nando's black card is my greatest, the one I feel
is
the
most. He's a
weapon. Yeah, it's just sad. No, look, my view on it was that we were going to sign George and the coaches. There's a lot of myth about who signs players at clubs. At Tigers, the coaches always had final say. I've never, ever been in a situation where somebody other than a coach had the final say. Although Cocker's allowed me one sort of wild card, which was Jordan Crane. Because if you remember that, do you remember the circumstances surrounding Jordan Crane and Lewis Moody?
No.
Lewis was coming back from an injury and we played Leeds in a second team game, one of those A-team games on a Monday night. And Jordan kept on running across Lewis's lines at the back of a line out. So Lewis, being Lewis, whacked him. So there's blood pouring out of Jordan's nose and down his face. And he went off to get seen to rather than the physio coming on. So he'd left a hole in the defensive line and Cocker's was going ballistic because I was saying, look, I think he's a good player and I think he's a good leader. And Cocker's going, but he wasn't dead and he left the defensive line.
He's soft.
Yes. Cocker's went, we can't sign him. Anyway, we did. And fortunately, that worked out. But generally, in almost in every other case, the coach decides. So they decided they wanted George. And all I said to Freddie was, look, you've got a contract. You can't sack somebody. You can't sack a player. Or you can, but you then have to pay them a settlement sum. And that settlement sum appears in the salary cap. So what you've effectively done is, if you sack a player, is you've paid to play for somebody else. That doesn't seem any point in that. But I said to Freddie, I said, in the negotiations with Bath, it's become pretty clear that they would take you as their first choice. I think the coach's view was that George would play in front of you. And that's in a sense been borne out by the selections this season. So all I said was, I think there's an opportunity for you to go to Bath if you want to be first choice. But it's not as good a story as the way Freddie tells it.
Garden leave's over. You're looking great. Tanned. Lean?
Not quite.
Leaner?
Relatively.
Yeah, well, you're looking great is what I'm trying to say. What does the future hold? Like, do you want to get back in to rugby? You've given some unbelievable stuff there, the complexities around it. You've been at the forefront, the coalface, the top table. You've seen the good, you've seen the bad. What's next?
Oh, look, I enjoy sport. I feel mentally very refreshed. There are some irons in the fire, which are very interesting. But what I've done in the last few weeks is I've been consulting to an agent called Ben Lewitt, who you will know having played with. Top bloke, cares about the players. Really, really enjoyed working with him. And for me, it completes the circle in a way, because when I was starting out as an agent, Alex Sanderson, the current Sale coach, was one of my clients. Alex had a friend who was coming to the end of his career who wanted to do something else. I gave him some work experience, called Richard Wilkes. Wilkesy and I worked together for 10 years in various law firms and had a whale of a time. He's a partner in the agency. He's gone to Tigers. I'm working with the agency, working with Wilksy in a way again, and working with Ben, loving that. So that might be a consistent thread, and it would be great if it was.
So poacher turned gatekeeper turned poacher again.
Exactly that.
It's like, hey, it's weird how it all comes round. Shout out to Ben Lewitt and his agency's Green Room Sports. Green Room Sports. And you can get your lid done as well, can't you? That's under the umbrella.
You can get your lid done.
I don't need
mine. I might have to go myself.
No, I think you're all right, actually. You've aged well in terms of hair. Simon, absolute pleasure, mate. Awesome to have you on. Thank you.
Thank you.
This episode is brought to you by Hotels.com. When I went on my last holiday to Cape Town, it was amazing. My friends were there, the weather was phenomenal, and most importantly, the food was fantastic. But one thing I struggled with was finding the right places to stay. You know, all I want is a great bed, a fantastic shower, and breakfast that doesn't end at 8 a.m. I'm on holiday, I'm still sleeping. I also like ease, and the Hotels.com app easily helps me to find a perfect hotel for every trip. Whether you're looking for a family-friendly getaway or a relaxing spa weekend, on the Hotels.com app, you can compare up to 5 hotels side by side. Now, why would you want to do that? So you can see prices, amenities, and star ratings. And best of all, you don't have to switch back and forth between options. See? Ease. So, start planning your next getaway and find your perfect somewhere in the Hotels.com app today.
This episode is brought to you by Maybelline New York. Get ready to bring the heat with Maybelline's newest lip plumping gloss, Lifter Plump. Fair warning though, it's hot. Like, literally. It's formulated with chili peppers to bring a heated sensation and an instant plumping effect that lasts. Available in 8 sizzling shades like Blush Blaze, Hot Honey, and more. Buy Lifter Plump now on Amazon and use the code 10PLUMP to get 10% off for a limited time. Tap the banner to learn more.